Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Today's show is about Buddhism. I want to start by saying a huge thanks in advance to my upcoming guest on the show. David McAfee is going to be back. He joined me just a few weeks back to talk about the Book of Gods, but he has religious studies background. He's authored 4 books. He's done a lot of writing about Buddhism, so he wanted to weigh in. It was brought to my attention that Bobby and Ashley from the No Religion Required podcast have a background in Buddhism, so I tapped them on the shoulder. They're going to join me. They're always fun. Mostly because they sort of filter their skepticism and awesomeness through these wonderfully warm Southern accents. It's just amazing. So looking forward to talking to them. I've got Stephen Batchelor. He is a secular Buddhist. He's going to join me for a bit to talk about the work and speaking that he does about Buddhism all around the world. And of course, the input from our listening audience. So it's going to be an interesting show as we get into Buddhism. Now, I can predict already that there are going to be some people who are unhappy with this particular show, because I didn't represent their particular brand of Buddhism or because I wasn't a comprehensive course. It's a radio show. We're not going to do an absolutely complete profile of Buddhism in a show. It's just not going to happen. This is a broad stroke. This is an introduction. This is a 101. This is a handshake to Buddhism. So if we miss something, just chill, okay? We are still going to learn quite a bit about the 4th most popular religion on planet Earth. On the podcast schedule ahead of us, we're getting ready to do a show next Tuesday about food. Specifically, I'm interested in the bad science, the pseudoscience, food woo, the junk science, the bad ideas, the misinformation surrounding food and food-related warnings, the good and the bad and the ugly, the stuff on the internet especially that tells us how to eat better. And of course, all those ideas contradict each other. And we're going to talk as well about a certain nutrition celebrity that's been riding this wave of fame and popularity, a huge wave of fame, on pretty much a complete lack of credibility. And, of course, I'm talking about the Food Babe. So the show next Tuesday is called Health, Wootrition, and the Food Babe. Now, the Food Babe is Vani Hari. She's an author and activist, and she's been very successful. She's been all over television. And, you know, she's the one who called out Subway for using harmful chemicals in its bread. And those harmful chemicals were actually totally harmless. It was just a food additive. She's the one that took Starbucks to task for having carcinogens in their pumpkin spice lattes. That was bogus. She was behind this petition to stop Kraft Foods from using artificial orange color in mac and cheese. And Kraft acquiesced, and they took the coloring out, and mac and cheese is really no more or less healthy today than it was then. The Food Babe is the one who freaked out and warned everybody about propylene glycol in beer. Oh my God, there's propylene glycol in beer, because it's a chemical that's used in antifreeze, and you're putting it in your body, and of course, everybody flips out. She'd apparently mistaken propylene glycol with propylene glycol alginate. Totally different thing, not even close to the same chemical, and that's derived from kelp, and it's harmless. But she freaked out about it anyway. So she's the one who's always ringing the alarm bell about big food and all those scary industrial-sounding ingredients in our food. And she has been so out there that she's caused actual experts, like Dr. Stephen Novella of the Yale University School of Medicine, to call her the Jenny McCarthy of food. That's how bad it's gotten. Well, Dr. Stephen Novella is going to join me. He's going to be a guest on next week's show, and he's a smart guy, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. I'm also going to have 2 registered dietitian nutritionists on, you know, experts in actual experts in nutrition to talk about food and food woo. And specifically in relation to the Food Babe, I had to have Yvette D'Entremont back on the show. Yvette, of course, is the Psy Babe. She's an actual scientist, and she has been a public and frequent critic of Vanihari's claims. And she has this particular brand of sarcastic skepticism that it's hard to describe. You just have to hear Yvette in action. So when she's on the radio next week, all bets are off. Just hold on to your hat. It's going to be a very interesting and entertaining show. It's called Health, Wootrition, and the Food Babe. And of course, 2 weeks from today, it's our annual Halloween tradition. It's Ghost Stories. One of my favorite shows of the year as we lower the lights and sit around the virtual campfire and get in the Halloween spirit with ghost stories. Ed Suominen was kind enough to write an original work for me to highlight on the show. I've shared his writings before. He's always really good at storytelling. And again, I'll cap the show with something of my own that's going to kind of be a big finish. So get ready as we get in the Halloween spirit together. Now today, before we get into our pursuit of Buddhist bliss together, you should know that there are several really good lectures about Buddhism online at today's show sponsor, The Great Courses Plus. The Great Courses Plus actually has over 7,000 different courses, and they're taught by award-winning professors and experts in their fields on a host of topics. You know, we can go Buddhism, you can do Christianity, you can do Islam, you can do a host of religions, history, computers, biology, music, medicine, cooking, gardening, foreign languages, so many subjects and courses that help to better ourselves, that help us know more tomorrow than we knew yesterday. I recently finished Bart Ehrman's series on how Jesus became God. That's fascinating stuff, taught by Ehrman himself at The Great Courses Plus. I think that course alone is reason enough to check them out. Information, education, learning that streams right into your home, into your office, on your TV, your computer screen. You can stream it on your smartphone. Right now, my listeners get a whole month of unlimited access to The Great Courses Plus lectures for free for 30 days with sign up. Start your free month right now and go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth Andrews. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth Andrews. Okay, Buddhism. I mentioned earlier it was the fourth largest religion on the planet, 360 million followers worldwide. Centered around the Buddha, the awakened one, a man named Siddhartha Gautama, born 2,500 years ago. I'm going to give you the story of Siddhartha in just a second. But first, I actually want to start with a conversation from one of our listeners, a gentleman who had emailed me and said he was a practicing Buddhist and would like to weigh in. So I'll just start right there. His name is Dan. Now, Dan, you are a practicing Buddhist today.
Yeah, I am a practicing Buddhist, have been since 1970 when I became an adult, and have been studying it academically and personally for all this time.
I'm getting a ton of correspondence from people who are just horrified, mortified, terrified. I'm going to screw it up. You're going to do a show. You're going to screw this up, Seth. You know, you don't know Buddha. You just let me do it, is what they essentially are saying.
Oh, yeah.
And so you tell me. You have an insider's perspective. Define Buddhism and how you practice, okay?
All right. Very simply, Buddhism is a non-theistic religion. That basically means that there is no deity per se, although let me give you a caveat on that, Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism does tend to deify the Buddha and have some spirits and that kind of stuff. But basically, no, it is non-theistic. It is a philosophy of how to alleviate your own self-created suffering. It is not of worship, even though there are tons of statues. But of course, during that time, there weren't too many photographers around. So, you know, some 2,500 years ago. So they made statues, and I have a great deal of reverence for the founder named Siddhartha. So I got involved with it by making a mistake and talking to one of my friends who was a Buddhist. And I said, so you worship statues? And he came out and just about strangled me for that. And said, no, we don't do that. But basically explained that it's a way of living that makes life a heck of a lot easier. And since I've started practicing it by following what they call the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, that it works out quite simply, even though it can be a devil at a time.
Is Buddhism like tailored clothing? Everybody's kind of measuring it to fit them. For some people, it may be a theistic religion, right? Do they paint Buddhism with spiritual language? Do they believe in a supernatural plane of any kind?
Oh, I'm sure there are some. And again, especially the Tibetans, they tend to do that a lot more. But basically, it is a situation of just, well, how would you put it? Very simply, it's a way of knocking off your own created suffering. That's about it.
What's your uncreated suffering? What am I talking about here?
Okay. We'll start off with guilt, the need for things, or getting stuck on things like desires. Is you'll hear a lot of people say that, oh, yeah, it's about eliminating desire. No, it's the attachment to the desire. For example, if you want a pizza and you go to the store and they don't have pizza, they're out of it. And if you detach from that desire and say, yeah, it's nice to have a pizza, but I can't find it, I'll wait till tomorrow, you're not going to suffer. You'll have something else to eat instead. But some people, oh, I've got to do it. And they've got to run to three or four or five different stores and the pizza shops are closed and all that. And they create their own suffering on that.
What do most people, in your opinion, get wrong about Buddhism?
Well, let's start off with, first of all, they'll call it that it is a religion, but it can't be because there's no deity in most cases. But there are two different definitions of religion. Number one is that it's a belief in a deity and a teaching about that. The second is a moral or ethical practice, which the second one is how Buddhism fits in, because it's a practice of ethics on how to stop creating your own suffering. They also go to Chinese restaurants and see the fat statue there and say, oh, yeah, that's the Buddha. And quite to the contrary, that is a Chinese mythical character, if you wish, named Hotei, who was very filthy. But after he cleaned up his act, he became loved by children and so on and so forth. Not the same person as Siddhartha. In fact, Siddhartha was quite thin to the point where he was practicing to find a way of stopping suffering, that he would eat only one grain of rice a day. And it so happened that in doing so, he went obviously quite hypoglycemic, passed out into a stream, and the cold water thankfully woke him up and realized, well, that's not the way of doing it either. So he got out and thought, okay, being full of riches, which he was prior to starting this quest, didn't work. Starving yourself to death doesn't work. So maybe there's something in the middle. And he came up with what's known as the middle path. You know, don't go to extremes. Everything in moderation, including every so often going off on the deep end. It's okay, because if you're not doing it all the time, big deal.
I'm reviewing the unwholesome mental states that impede my progress toward enlightenment. There were five hindrances listed. You're familiar with these?
I've heard of them. I don't have them in front of me at the moment.
Sensuous lust.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, that's a problem. Aversion and ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. So not sure I line up with those five, Dan. I want to have skeptical doubt and occasionally sensuous lust, damn it.
Yeah. Oh, that could be very nice. But the last one that you have, the issue of being skeptical. In fact, that is what Siddhartha taught, is to be skeptical, to question everything. Don't take things on face value, but really look into it. And if it doesn't fit what you want, including his teachings, don't bother with it. So it's quite a bit different than what a lot of people think.
You do meditation, yoga, any of that stuff?
I meditate once in a while. In fact, I was known when I was living in Japan for 14 years to meditate while riding my bicycle to and from work. So it's a little...
How to frame that for me. You're doing what? You are spaced out? Are you breathing? What are you? I mean, what are we? Oh. What's meditation for you?
For me, it's being in the now, I guess you could say. It's not thinking about other things that I have to do later on, not thinking about the past, but what's the saying? Be here now, I guess, is a popular New Age thing. But it's just an issue of being aware of where I am right at the moment.
I can work on that. I'm always doing a laundry list of shit that I've got to do and that I haven't done. And I have a hard time flipping the switch off. I have a hard time being in the now. I guess that's a common thing you probably hear. That's why Buddhism is attractive to many, right? It causes them to remove all of the what should I be doing, what haven't I done, and try to be about what's happening at the moment. Huh?
Right. And on top of that, it is okay to think about those things every so often, but just not when you're doing things like driving somewhere, if you have an appointment, because you may be so wrapped up in what you're thinking, you'll bypass the turn that you wanted to take and wake up a couple of minutes later and going, oh, crud, I'm late. And then have to turn around and undo everything that you've done in that line.
So Buddhism, from your perspective, not a religion. You can be an atheist Buddhist, and it totally works.
Oh, absolutely. It is a religion as the area of being an ethical practice. But as for any worship, no, not at all. There is no prayer even in it. So, yeah, it's you can be an atheist Buddhist. I know of a number of priests and ministers who are Christian who are Buddhists. I know some Jewish Buddhists as well.
All right. Anything else that you'd like to toss in before I move on?
Okay, just real quickly, there are five great precepts for those who really want to get serious, and that is don't do harm to other people, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, which even means without permission, don't go lusting after other people, but you know that kind of slips by every so often, no lying and no intoxicants. So again, you can be Buddhist without even doing any of those, but as long as you're trying to stop the suffering.
It could be argued you could do any of those without being Buddhist.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, Dan. Well, I appreciate your perspective, and thanks for being a part of the broadcast, man.
My pleasure, sir.
Let's go back. Let's go back to 2,500 years ago, 500 years before the alleged birth of Jesus Christ. Let's go back to the birth of Siddhartha Gautama. Many legends, so many legends surrounding this man. Here's one of the big ones. The story goes like this. Before Siddhartha was born, his mother, who was a queen, had a dream. And in the dream, there was a beautiful white elephant. And the elephant offered the queen a lotus flower as a gift. And then the elephant entered the side of her body. The queen awoke and she was curious as to what the dream meant. And so she asked some interpreters. And they said that the dream meant she was one day going to give birth to a great son. And that son would be one of two things. He would be either a powerful ruler, or he would be a great holy man. He would be a conqueror, or he would be the Buddha, the awakened one. The story goes that the baby boy emerged from her side only 10 months later. And he was already walking and talking when he was born. Only 7 days later, his mother, the queen, died. Siddhartha Gautama was believed born in India, in southern Nepal, at the foot of the Himalayas. It's a site which is today considered one of the holiest places on planet Earth. It's a place where so many Buddhists will make a pilgrimage to go pay homage, to meditate, to honor, and to pray. Now, Siddhartha's story was not written down for about 500 years. It was actually passed down through oral tradition, you know, it was spoken from person to person, taught and told as a story from person to person for generations, 500 years. And for that reason, it's impossible to know how much of his story is based in fact and how much is just fiction and fantasy. What's truth? What's legend? What really happened? And what have people just made up? It's impossible to know. But for so many Buddhists, that doesn't matter. It's not about verifying what happened in real life. It's not about knowing the real Siddhartha. It's the story itself that is important and the philosophy born of it. That's the important thing. That's the thing to focus on. The story goes like this. Siddhartha was the son of a king. He was wealthy. He lived in the lap of luxury. He was spoiled, freaking rotten. He was pampered and protected in a way that really only royalty can know. Totally isolated from the real world, the suffering of the real world, the plights of everyday people in everyday places, he was totally insulated from that. That world for him really didn't exist. And as he grew into his teen years, he served every indulgence. He had the most and best of pretty much everything. It would be years later, as an adult, that he would sort of peer over the kingdom walls out of his safe zone and he would see the real world. He would become introduced to the old and the destitute and the poor and the suffering and the hungry and the needy. What he came to see as the human condition. afflictions of all kinds, affecting all people in all places. It was everywhere. And he began to see, in perspective, in context, the insulated life he had been living, and that he, too, was not immune from suffering. He would not always be young and fit and healthy and protected. One day, reality, the real world, was going to bring him the same fate as it was bringing so many others. He would get old, he would get sick, he would suffer, and he would one day die. How had he been so naive, he thought. He'd felt suffering in his life in regard to the death of his mother specifically. And one day he himself would die. His life would be over. This temporary thing would be done. He was 29 years old, and his father wanted him desperately to inherit the mantle, to take over the kingdom, to wield power, to assume his title as a conqueror and leader. And Siddhartha rejected all of it. He was beginning to realize in his own mind, or at least suspect, that true fulfillment did not lie in all this cheap materialism, all the unsatisfying affluence and excess that was all around him. He had it, but he did not have fulfillment and contentment and happiness. There was a void, a vacuum. There was something missing. He needed serenity and peace beyond the pain and suffering of this fragile life. He had a wife and a newborn son at home. But he left it behind. He left his kingdom behind. He left everything behind to find something else, essentially to become someone else, to gain everything by losing everything. He changed everything about himself, his clothes, cut his hair, essentially assuming a new identity. And he set off on a new course in his life. He became poverty incarnate. For he once had everything, now he had nothing. He had to beg for his food and a place to sleep. He looked around and saw this growing dissatisfaction among his fellow human beings, many of them practicing their Vedic religions and worshiping Vedic gods. They were deeply religious, but they were unsatisfied. They were unhappy. They were suffering. He began to suspect that it wasn't the gods at the end of these practices that provided any fulfillment, but perhaps fulfillment came through the practices themselves. People were seeking satisfaction and contentment and happiness because unhappiness and restlessness and dissatisfaction were so prevalent. People were trying to slough off in many ways the inherited religions of their families and cultures and get back to the basics. Legend says Siddhartha had had many past lives. He had been at times a human, he'd been an animal, he'd even been a number of gods, different deities. He'd existed in various incarnations from plane to plane. And with every plane of existence, he would increase knowledge and wisdom. You know, rebirth to rebirth. It's like he was adding a layer to the onion. And Siddhartha found a teacher, a man who taught self-reflection and practiced yoga, meditation, trying to wrestle control over the passions that so often dominate us and govern us and control us, taught him how to center his mind and his body. Yet Siddhartha remained unsatisfied because the liberation he felt, the bliss that he felt when it came, was only temporary. In fact, he went through a series of teachings and masters, remaining unsatisfied. He decided that perhaps a way to deal with suffering would be to induce suffering in his own life, to subject his own physical body and mind to great suffering, perhaps get in front of it, to take control in that way. And so he started to eat barely any food. He wore barely any clothing to protect against the elements. He denied the flesh. He shed so much of this life in an attempt to in some way become born again. And he denied himself and he inflicted suffering upon himself for 6 full years. Seeking transcendence. He starved himself nearly to death. He would spend long hours standing on one foot, just balancing on one foot, disciplining himself not to fall. He slept on a bed of nails. His body looked like that of an emaciated corpse. And yet, even after all these years, the gauntlet of pain and deprivation did not bring him the answers he was looking for. It was a story about how he, at this time, had a memory about his youth when he was with his dad and he was out in a big field. And he looked around and he began to connect all life. Human life, animal life, insect life, all life connected in existence and in death. And his perception about life began to change. That perhaps the underlying current, you know, of this world is not necessarily that of pain, but of joy and of goodness. It's right in front of us if only we see it, if only we focus upon it. And he realized at that moment that suffering was not the answer. He just had this epiphany and decided, no more. I'm going to take care of my body. I'm going to nourish myself in body and soul. And at that second, he looked up and there was a woman. She just mysteriously appeared and she was holding a bowl of rice, which she offered to him. This tiny gesture, this supposedly insignificant gesture, and yet for him it was overwhelming, it was amazing, it was superlative. It was around this time he decided he was going to stop looking out there for the answers to bliss and contentment and satisfaction and joy. Instead of looking out there, he was going to begin looking from within. And so he made a pact with himself. He was going to go to a Bodhi tree, and he was going to sit under it and meditate. Fervently meditate until he figured this thing out. Right there in the shadow of nature itself, he had pledged himself just to stay in that moment and focus until he had found enlightenment. The dark spirits did not like this. You see, the god Mara, the god of desire, feeds on the passions of humankind. And if Siddhartha was to discover that humankind could conquer its passions, control its passions, center itself, then those gods would have nothing to be nourished upon. And so the god Mara brought an army of demons and accosted Siddhartha under the tree, trying to disrupt this centeredness, this focus, this quest for enlightenment. But Siddhartha would not be unhinged. He sat there totally focused under the Bodhi tree, tapping into the cycle of birth and death and beauty and nature and peace. Siddhartha connected with the earth by touching his fingers to the ground, and the outward ripple drove the demons and Mara away. And as he was there, connecting to the cycle of birth and death, beauty and nature and peace, the Bodhi tree began to rain down flowers all around him. And Siddhartha achieved his enlightenment, his nirvana. Awakened, he was the Buddha. Buddha says that this power to understand ourselves, to achieve centeredness and peace and enlightenment, this power exists within all of us, in the here and in the now. If only we will stop and focus, we can truly see it. There's beauty all around us. There's beauty everywhere we look, in the smallest and simplest of things, in the most fleeting of seconds, if only we will stop to look at it. And it will nourish us. A famous quote attributed to Siddhartha says this: a man traveling across a field encountered a tiger. He fled, the tiger after him. Coming to a precipice, he caught hold of the root of a wild vine and swung himself down over the edge. The tiger sniffed at him from above. Trembling, the man looked down to where, far below, another tiger was waiting to eat him. Only the vine sustained him. Two mice, one white and one black, little by little started to gnaw away the vine. The man saw a luscious strawberry near him. Grasping the vine with one hand, he plucked the strawberry with the other. How sweet it tasted. The Buddha has said, no one saves us but ourselves. No one can and no one may. We ourselves must walk the path. Every morning we are born again. What we do today is what matters most. And the Buddha became a teacher. He was compelled to share his teachings, the right way of living, the Dharma, to the world. We're going to talk about the Dharma and the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and more about the basic tenets of Buddhism in just a second. First, I want to speak with author and activist David McAfee, who has done some writing about Buddhism, specifically about whether or not Buddhism is a superstitious religion, and he joins me here. Hey, David, how are you, sir?
It's going pretty great. Thanks for having me on again.
I know you've got a dog in this fight, or at least you've got an interest in it because you've done some writing about it. Writing in what capacity?
Well, when it comes to Buddhism, I haven't done any specific books or anything. I've written a lot of essays, and when I was in college, I majored in religious studies, and Buddhism was one of the major religions that I went over in many classes. So today, when I hear people claiming it's not a religion, I'm just, these are mostly people who have never taken even the most basic introductory religion class.
That brings us, though, back to the argument that it's a religion in the sense that it is a system of ethics. My first caller, Dan, I think had referenced his using of Buddhism as a framework for living.
That's perfectly fine. And for him or for some people, it may not be a religion that they are practicing, but Buddhism itself is a religion. And there are many denominations, just like there are with any religion, that's split up into tons of variety of sects. And some of those sects, perhaps Zen Buddhism, your friend might be practicing that version, claims to be more of a way of life and a philosophy, but it's still a part of Buddhism, which is at its root a religion with monks and temples and statues and supernatural aspects and reincarnation, and even in some of its varieties, gods, belief in gods.
I always enjoy watching people define and describe Zen, because it's sort of this ever-moving goalpost. It's hard for me to nail it down.
I completely agree. I mean, Zen Buddhism is a very widely practiced denomination of Buddhism that emphasizes meditation and well-being and inner self-reflection. But Zen itself is just a vague religious concept at its base, just like a lot of things that you can't really nail down when you start talking about supernatural aspects.
How deep have you gone into the subject of Buddhism? I mean, what can you tell us that we wouldn't already read on most basic websites or a wiki page or something, you know?
Well, a lot of people don't know. One of the most common misconceptions about Buddhism is that, other than that it isn't a religion, is that it isn't violent, that its practitioners are purely peaceful, that there's no violence ever taken place in the name of Buddhism, and it's just not true. Just like any religion, it has doctrines and dogmas, and one of those essential tenets of Buddhism is that it does allow for violence in cases of self-defense. And so because there is that loophole, it has allowed wars, countless wars throughout history, to have been taken place in the name of Buddhism, because they're saying, well, this is a self-defense war that we're fighting. And it's just like with Christianity, you see that one of the Ten Commandments is not to kill people. Does that stop Christians from killing people? It certainly has not throughout history. And it's just like with any religion, they'll find their loopholes. And if you want to see this in the world today, then you have to look at Myanmar, where they have institutionalized Buddhism, as in their government is a Buddhist government. And we see some of the most heinous actions ever taking place right there. Just a few years ago, they limited the Muslims in the area from having more than two children. And this is an unprecedented move. Nobody has ever barred a religious group from having children until this Myanmar government did. And they're also charging people for blasphemy, for insulting Buddhism. I mean, institutionalized Buddhism looks a lot like institutionalized Islam.
Prepare yourself for the hate and death that's about to hit your email inbox, man, because
I get it all the time, but it's facts that, I mean, they're backed up by data, and there are tons of books about the history of violence in Buddhism that people just choose to ignore because they kind of practice this westernized, whitewashed version of Buddhism.
Is the Dalai Lama considered a deity or spiritual holy man?
I would say a spiritual holy man would be a more accurate description. I know there are some versions, some denominations of Buddhism that consider the Dalai Lama a god incarnate. However, most do not. Most Buddhists don't even consider the original Buddha, Gautama Buddha, don't consider him a god either. However, there are supernatural deities that Buddha discussed, that he talked about, that a lot of traditional Buddhist practitioners still believe in. It's not the one God that you might think about in a Western culture, but just tons and tons of gods at different levels of the universe.
His is a Tibetan form of Buddhism.
Yes, that's the Dalai Lama's version, yes.
And what's his shtick? I mean, is it love one another? Because I see, you know, the Dalai Lama memes posted all over the place, and people are quoting the Dalai Lama, and it's mostly what I see anyway, and this is these are cherry-picked quotes mined for the purpose of almost a saccharine inspiration. Perhaps there's true inspiration to be found, but, you know, it's love one another right now kind of stuff, right?
Yes. The Dalai Lama's job is to interpret the writings of the Buddha and provide it to a lot of people all at once. Basically, he's doing his job very well by utilizing social media and by getting TV appearances when he can. He spoke at my college graduation. So, I mean, he's really getting the word out there and trying his best to promote the best examples of Buddhism. And I think he's doing a great job. He's even said at times that if Buddhism is contradicted by science, then Buddhism must change, is what he said. And you wouldn't hear most religious leaders saying something like that about their religion.
But you would consider him a religious leader?
Oh, he's definitely a religious leader on par with the Pope or something like that. I mean, it's just a different type of religious leader, and he happens to be a champion of more liberal values, which has been helpful. For more reading on lamas throughout history, there's a book called Foreigner at the Lama's Feet, In Curators of the Buddha, The Study of Buddhism Under Colonialism, and that has a lot of information on how past Dalai Lamas have acted and how they've justified war and violence.
I remember when I was researching Hinduism for Sacred Cows, and it was, you know, Hinduism has so many thousands of splinters in it that it's impossible to nail down. I mean, the minute you say it is this, there will always be someone two steps to the right or left or front or back who say, no, it's not, it's this. Mm-hmm. And it becomes this living organism, you know, this thing that continues to morph and mutate through the ages. It makes it very difficult to qualify and quantify what it is and what it isn't.
That's exactly right. And oddly enough, Buddhism is one of those splinters of Hinduism. Hinduism is one of the oldest religions that we have recorded that actually have papers and holy books for, as opposed to just cave drawings. And one of its earlier incarnations that emphasized meditation and the ascetic lifestyle, one of those became Buddhism. So Buddhism definitely has a lot of similarities. And now Buddhism is itself splintering over time. But because Hinduism is one of the oldest, you'll never find anything more contradictory and confusing. So sorry you had to research that. That was fun in college for me.
Well, I mean, I wasn't doing a thesis on it. It would have driven me mad. It would have been just way over the top for a guy like me. I just found it fascinating to see that one god is related to another. Perhaps they're the same gods, or no, they're not. They're an incarnation or a child of, or what have you, and the gods are animals, and it just blows your mind. So
that was fun. Now it's taking me back to college, and I'm excited again. I'm gonna research more.
Well, what would you take and what would you leave about Buddhism? I mean, are there things you admire and things that you lament about what it is?
Oh, definitely. I think people assume that I'm anti-Buddhist and that I hate everything Buddhism, but it's really not the case. I appreciate a lot about the religion. I just mentioned the Dalai Lama's comment about it needing to catch up with science if there are any contradictions, and I still completely agree with that. I think there's nothing wrong with utilizing the good aspects of any religion, whether it's Buddhism, Christianity, or anything else, if you exclude the superstition and the harmful beliefs. And many people do exactly like that, and they live long, happy, healthy lives. Personally, however, I don't see the need to adopt religion because I have a strong set of values built over time and research, and because I don't see anything that religions offer, either ethically or psychologically, that can't be found elsewhere. But Buddhism, as far as religions are concerned, it has more introspection involved. It's a more meditative practice. I would say that by and large, it's more calming and more peaceful. That doesn't mean that all its practitioners are calm and peaceful, but the dogma itself is superior to most Abrahamic teachings, I think.
David G. McAfee, you can find his work, his writings, you can find it at davidgmcafee.com. Dave, thanks for your perspective on all of this and for being a part of the broadcast. I'm sure your inbox and mine will see a healthy response from this short conversation. We'll see what everybody else has to say as well, okay?
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
David McAfee had mentioned that the Dalai Lama had at one point said, well, if science proves something and gives us new information, we have to follow it. I'm paraphrasing, but it reminds me of another quote attributed to Siddhartha, the Buddha. It goes like this, quote, "Do not believe in anything simply because you've heard it. Do not believe in anything simply because it is spoken and rumored by many. Do not believe in anything simply because it is found written in your religious books. Do not believe in anything merely on the authority of your teachers and elders. Do not believe in traditions because they've been handed down for many generations. But after observation and analysis, when you find that anything agrees with reason, and is conducive to the good and benefit of one and all, then accept it and live up to it. Let's talk about the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, shall we? Truth number one is this: suffering exists. Suffering isn't necessarily overt suffering, like you're in agony. Suffering means, in this context, the unsatisfactory nature of temporary states and temporary things. And this includes the things that bring us temporary joy. They don't really count as true happiness because they're fleeting and they're gone. Number two, suffering arises from attachment to desires. Number three, suffering ceases when the attachment to desire ceases. And noble truth number four, freedom from suffering is possible by practicing the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path, often represented by the Dharma Wheel. And the Dharma Wheel has eight spokes, and each of these spokes represents the right elements of the path. And you'll hear the word right: right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, etc. And right in this context is not used in a dogmatic way. This is the only right way to do it. It's not that. It's more like right is efficient. It's effective. The Eightfold Path, number one, is a right view to keep ourselves free from prejudice, superstition, and delusion, to see the world as it truly is, to see the true nature of life. Number two is right thought, to turn away from the evils of this world and to direct ourselves toward righteousness. Number three, right speech, to refrain from gossip and pointless and harmful talk, and to be kind, to speak courteous and kind words to others. Number four is right conduct, to see that what we do, our actions, our deeds, are peaceful, benevolent, compassionate, and pure, to live in our own lives the teachings of the Buddha. Number five, right livelihood, to make sure that what we do for a living doesn't have evil consequences. It doesn't harm others. Number six, a right effort, to direct our efforts constantly to the overcoming of ignorance and selfish desires. Number seven is right mindfulness, to cherish good and pure thoughts for all that we say and do. Everything arises from our thoughts. And number eight, right meditation, to concentrate our will on the Buddha, his life, and his teaching. That is the Eightfold Path. Had a listener named Rick say, "I'm a longtime listener. I'm a former evangelical Christian myself. I lost my faith in my mid-20s and became an atheist and a skeptic, largely because of the influence of watching Matt Dillahunty on The Atheist Experience. A few years later, I started experiencing intense and long-lasting feelings of anxiety, not related to being an atheist, just bad brain chemistry, I think. I was eventually diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. My search for a solution to my anxiety issues led me to meditation as a potential treatment, which led me to Buddhist teachings. I'm still an atheist and a skeptic, and I'm not sure if I can rightly call myself a Buddhist. I don't believe in any of the supernatural stuff like karma or reincarnation. However, I do believe in the more naturalistic and philosophical portions of Buddhist doctrine. I also use meditation techniques that were developed by Buddhists in my day-to-day life, and I'll say they've helped me to greatly tame my anxiety and other negative emotions. Overall, I think that Buddhism and atheism-humanism are quite complementary, and I think most atheists could learn a lot from Buddhist philosophy." Rick, thanks for the email. Much appreciated, man. I'd asked some of our listeners on Facebook about Buddhism. Here are just a few of the responses. Jay said, "As far as whether or not Buddhism is a religion, it would be the same as saying following the teachings of Confucius, Plato, or Socrates are religions. You can turn anything into a religion. I myself go to the church of MLB, Major League Baseball. I'm just trying to figure out how to get a tax write-off on the game tickets and hats I buy." Darren said, "No, it's not a religion, but the chanting makes it weird like one." Nate appeared on the thread with a joke that said the Dalai Lama went up to a hot dog vendor in New York City and said, "Hey, can you make me one with everything?" Dr. Daryl Ray weighed in. He said, yes, it is a religion, and the question should be asked in light of how it's practiced by the millions of Buddhists in Vietnam, Thailand, etc., not on what the California Buddhists try to sell. What a religion says and what it does are almost always at odds. Islam is the religion of peace, like Christianity is the religion of love, for example. Buddhism is a highly superstitious belief system, and the Dalai Lama, among others, may give secular soundbites, but their behavior betrays deep superstitions, like saying that homosexuality is abnormal, that humans and animals have a non-corporeal existence, e.g. a soul-like thing, or that there's life in some way after death. It's definitely a religion as much as any of the others, it just plays a better game in some places. Buddhists in conflict with Hindus or Muslims certainly are no different than any other religion. Michelle said there are people who swear the Christianity they practice is a philosophy and not a religion. Wasn't that Bill O'Reilly's line when he was talking to David Silverman on the O'Reilly Factor? Doesn't make Christianity any less a religion. Same applies to Buddhism. Rob said, no God equals no religion. It does have ritual and is a one-way philosophy. You can only escape the suffering of life by following the teachings of Buddha. I love life as an atheist. Next up in our discussion is Stephen Batchelor. He is a contemporary Buddhist teacher. He was born in Scotland. He currently lives in France. He speaks all around the world about Buddhism and conducts meditation seminars. He runs the website stephenbatchelor.org. And Stephen joins me here on the show. Stephen, it's great to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Seth.
Let's start with your background. You speak to this issue for what reason? Give me the foundation of all this.
The foundation of all this. Well, when I was 18, as a child of the 1960s, I fled the British Isles, where I had been brought up and educated, and went overland to India, without a particular goal in mind, apart from just sort of going along with this kind of hippie drift east. But within a couple of days of arriving in India, I ended up in the community around the Dalai Lama, up in North India in the Himalayas. And within a very short period, I became completely fascinated with Buddhism, particularly in this case, the Tibetan form thereof. And I more or less decided then and there that this was what I was going to focus my life upon. I may not have put it quite in those words at the time, but effectively that's what I did. I've not really done anything else. I've not been to university. I don't have any academic qualifications, but I have immersed myself for the last 40-odd years in the study and the practice of Buddhism, not just in one particular school. I was trained initially as a Tibetan Buddhist monk. I was a monk for 10 years. I then did a training in a Korean Zen monastery. And then when I disrobed and came back to Europe, to England, when I was about 30, I focused primarily on the early Buddhist teachings that we find in the language called Pali, which is probably as close as we'll get to what the Buddha might have spoken. And I became particularly interested in the historical figure of the Buddha, who this man was, not this god, and what he taught and why it seems to have made such a difference to people's lives. And since then, I've really been involved in trying to interpret the Dharma, or what the Buddha taught, in the light of our current understanding of the world. In other words, a world informed by the natural sciences, a world informed by Greek and Christian traditions to some degree historically, and a world in which we operate in liberal democratic societies and value things like historical criticism. And yet still there are big questions of life. You know, what does this all mean? Why am I here? What is death? These are questions that, although they're usually thought of as being of religious in nature, I feel are basically existential. Anyone who wishes to live an examined life, as Socrates put it, will address these questions. And my interest in Buddhism is to take it out of the sphere of religion, religious belief, priestly authority, and to translate these ideas into a language of our contemporary secular world. So what I'm developing at the moment is what is loosely being called secular Buddhism or secular Dharma, which more or less is relinquish the religious trappings of Buddhism and is seeking to find a new voice, a new way of life that will speak to people irrespective of their interests in formal Buddhist traditional practice.
You brought the word up earlier. Let's tackle Zen. can you help define Zen for members of our audience?
Well, Zen is largely known today as a school of Buddhism that has flourished in Japan. Zen is a Japanese term, and its primary focus is on meditation. Its origins actually of Zen find themselves in China in about the 6th or 7th century of the Common Era, and those teachings and practices then travel to Korea, where I studied it, then on to Japan. And it's a form of Buddhism that is very stripped down. They've dropped a lot of the doctrine, and they really focused on firsthand actual experience of life. And also Zen is very much expressed through the arts, through poetry, through painting, through tea ceremonies, through gardens and so on. So I feel a very strong affinity to the Zen tradition. But on the other hand, if you go to Korea or Japan or China today and go to a Zen monastery, you'd probably be more struck by its rather rigid, somewhat religious nature. And that aspect of it, again, I don't really have much time for, but I'm very interested in the early tradition of Zen, its emphasis on questioning, of meditation practice, on the arts.
As someone who has heard the definition so many times, I'm in this odd position, Stephen, where I still don't really know what it is. Is it a state of mind? Is it a point of a focus? Is it a philosophy?
It's all of those. You see, once you get, if you pick Zen apart, you end up with the same problem as trying to figure out what Buddhism is. It's, again, many schools, many different traditions, many teachers, many developments in the 20th century, for example. I would personally say that it's basically a perspective on life that is grounded in a fundamental question, which in some forms of the tradition, they would articulate as, what is this? What is this that is going on right now? And holding that as an inquiry without giving into the mind's habit to jump at some clever answer, but just learning to experience one's life as a question rather than a set of more or less interesting facts, being grounded in a sensibility that engages all the senses, the way we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, feel, and seeking to live one's life more spontaneously, more openly, less constrained by, religious dogma or even Zen tradition in a way, and trying to, again, find a voice.
Would that qualify as living in the moment? Is that the right terminology that's used in Buddhism, to be in the moment?
Yeah, you can say living in the moment, but you'll find all Buddhist schools would emphasize that. But what's distinctive with Zen is, to some extent, its Chinese character. You see, what happened with Buddhism is that it starts in India, and then after about 500 years, it ends up in China. And in that process, teachings and practices that were really very much rooted in the Indian tradition encountered a culture, a society, a very sophisticated society even then, that saw the world quite differently. And so you've got basically a conversation, a dialogue, went on for probably a couple of centuries, really. But at the end of the day, this dialogue generated a form of Buddhism that wasn't uniquely Indian anymore, nor was it exclusively Chinese, because it had this interaction with a non-Chinese culture. And the product, or one of the products, we could call Zen, or Chan, as it's called in Chinese. So this is, you see what's happening. And I think something very similar is happening now. Effectively, Buddhism is coming into an encounter with modernity. And I don't even want to say the West anymore, because we're talking about a globalized modernity that is based upon the European Enlightenment, perhaps, but nonetheless is now part and parcel of an increasing, I would say almost a majority of those living on this earth at this moment. And Buddhism has to come to terms with modernity, and modernity is faced with the challenge of making sense of this ancient Indian, Chinese, Japanese tradition. And what will emerge down the line will be something we can't foresee. But I'm very curious and very excited, in a way, to be part of this intercultural exchange that's going on.
Stephen, have you ever or do you now believe in karma? What goes around is going to come around, Stephen. You know, it's what I keep hearing. Do you hold to that?
Well, okay. First of all, with considerable constraints. First, karma is just the Indian word for action.
So cause and effect, then?
No. It doesn't mean cause and effect. It just means action. You have another term, kama vipaka, which means action and result. And that's probably more what you're referring to. I certainly believe that every act that I commit, everything I say, everything I do, will have consequences. And I think as part of any ethical life, we need to be very attentive to what we think and how that translates into words and how or into actions, physical actions, both individually, communally, societally, and to pay attention to the consequences of those deeds. That's how the Buddha in the earliest texts describes karma. It's really quite a pragmatic way of looking at ethics, and it has to do more really with understanding how thoughts lead to words and deeds and the consequences that follow than it does with somehow, you know, according one's life to the mystical Tao or the cosmic law of cause and effect. I have no time for that kind of stuff. And in that sense, I don't believe in karma. But I do believe, I don't even have to believe it. It's self-evident that I try to live my life in which my thoughts and my deeds and my words come about in a responsible, hopefully in a wise way. And I pay attention to the effects that my work and my life has on others. And I use that as the kind of moral litmus test of how to live.
We've covered in a rudimentary way the Dharma. Can you explain or perhaps flesh out the Dharma for us?
Oh, I wish I could.
I know it's rather an encyclopedic topic with a very simple question. Forgive me for setting you up in this way. But if
okay.
You could give us the broad stroke
the
here.
Broad okay? Stroke. Okay, well, I'll actually cite a classical text. This is the Buddha's account of his own enlightenment. He describes his enlightenment as having come to see for himself the Dharma. And what he describes as the Dharma is, on the one hand, what he calls conditioned arising or contingency or conditionality, the fact that whatever you do will have a consequence, and if you refrain from doing that, then that consequence won't occur. So that's, I think, basically the principle of cause and effect in a way. Understanding the Dharma is a way of understanding the world without any need for any supernatural entity such as God or some kind of mystical underpinning like, you know, the Tao or something. It's a very empirical, somewhat matter-of-fact account of seeing how everything we do has consequences, and those consequences have consequences. And the second aspect of the Dharma is Nirvana. And again, Nirvana is, again, like Dharma, one of these rather exotic Buddhist terms. But basically all it means, it refers to those moments in our lives where we're no longer driven by our innate or conditioned reactivity of greed, of hatred, of kind of egotistic confusion. And the practice of the Dharma is basically cultivating a perspective on life that is less and less reactive. And this is where meditation comes in. Meditation is, or mindfulness, let's say, is the practice of learning to open up and sustain a quality of attention or a perspective on life that is not driven by one's instinctive and habitual reactive patterns. And the moments in which you experience your life as somehow not determined by these forces, those moments are moments of Nirvana. So Nirvana is a clear, open, non-reactive space of mind from which we can then respond to situations in life rather than just blindly react to them, as we very often do.
How would one meditate? Now, if you were to tell me, Seth, you need to center yourself, man. You need to meditate. Now what?
Well, again, meditation is very simple, but it's not easy. I can tell you right now, the listeners out there, if you want to meditate, this is what you do. You find a place in your apartment or your house, which is relatively quiet. You sit on a chair, you sit on a cushion, whatever turns you on, and you close your eyes and you start paying attention to the in-breath and the out-breath. You don't manipulate or control the breath. You just come to rest in that natural tidal rhythm of breathing, this primary relationship we have to life itself. And the first step in meditation is just to get the mind to slow down to become a little bit quieter, a little bit stiller. And if you haven't done it before, what is often rather shocking is you realize, you know, when you try to do this, follow these very, very simple instructions, the mind would rather do anything else. It would rather rush back into some memory, race ahead into the future, or just get caught up in a sort of free association of thoughts and emotions and fears and whatever it is. It's actually very challenging to just sit still, be quiet, and pay attention to what's going on in a way where you're not constantly being thrown out, thrown off track, or else what people do is they just start falling asleep, they get bored. It's quite challenging, but it's very simple, and I think it can be very life-changing. And we don't need to dress it up with all kinds of exotic religious or Buddhist beliefs or whatever. It's a very basic human act. Think of Pascal, the French mathematician and philosopher, said somewhere that the reason for all human unhappiness is because people are unable to sit quietly in a room. And that could come straight out of the mouth of the Buddha. It's a very simple acknowledgement that we're basically leading lives that, despite our conceit that we're in charge, we're in control, we're doing our thing, actually, our thing is being done to us. We're being driven in many ways by habitual patterns, fears, and so on. So this is about meditation is what brings us into a different relationship with our lives, somewhere where we can learn to live from, not just some escape where we can cut off from the world and gaze at our navels and feel blissful. Actually, meditation is sometimes brings up all kinds of very painful experiences in our lives. It's not a lot of fun. Necessarily.
I've asked this question before, I'll ask it of you. Is there something or are there things that people get wrong, consistently wrong? And you're out speaking and they say this and you go, no, 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 that's not right. And you have to correct the record. What are we misunderstanding about Buddhism?
Well, that's a can of worms. The this all depends really on, you know, what one's particular understanding is oneself. And frankly, I think people still think of Buddhism as largely an Indian religion. And so, as we've already had on this discussion, karma, when the next thing will come on will be reincarnation, as though these things are somehow intrinsic and essential to what the Buddha was talking about, whereas actually they're not. I mean, they are ideas that are shared in common with Hinduism, with Jainism, which are the other two major Indian religions that we know about. So they're not distinctively Buddhist ideas, and people become particularly fascinated by these things. I think it's all a bit of a red herring. I don't believe in reincarnation. On the other hand, I can't disprove it. I mean, I'm basically agnostic about it, but I think it's really missing the point. The point really is to actually have the courage and the openness to actually confront one's existence here and now. That's what matters. And Buddhism provides us with a set of tools, a set of skills, which are contemplative, ethical, philosophical, to enable us to live more fully in this world, here and now. It has to do with embracing the condition we're in, of letting go of the kind of reactive patterns that often, you know, derail us, learning to settle into these quiet, still, non-reactive moments. And then, and this is the crucial bit, at learning how to respond to life in a healthy, wise, caring, and compassionate way. That, to me, is what is central to Buddhist practice.
Stephen, how would someone find out more about you and your work?
Oh, that's,
where would you
send
them?
That's the question I was waiting for you to ask.
I'm a giver. So.
my most recent book is called After Buddhism, but if you're new to the topic, I wouldn't start there. I would start with a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs that was published by Riverhead about 20 years ago now. And also, you can you Google me and you'll find lots of audio talks, some video stuff on YouTube. Just follow your nose.
Stephen Batchelor, I'll make sure and include the link to your website in the description box of this broadcast. You've been very kind to offer your time for this discussion. Thank you so much for your work and for giving us sort of a behind-the-scenes look into Buddhism. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Seth. I hope all of you out there get some benefit from this. It's been great talking to you. Thanks.
How about some Buddhism with a heap and helping a Southern hospitality? That's coming up next as I talk to Bobby C. and Ashley from the No Religion Required podcast. They've got some deep background in Buddhism and are going to tell us all about it in just a second. Hang on. Bobby C. and Miss Ashley are skeptics in the Deep South. They're just terrific people. They are hosts of the radio podcast No Religion Required. And they've got some background in Buddhism. And I thought they'd make a great addition to today's radio show. So Bobby and Ashley, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
So you've decided you're going to throw your hat into this sort of, it's not a heated discussion, but everybody's got an opinion and everybody's opinion conflicts and clashes. Most abundantly, is Buddhism a religion or not? And I think people are squaring off all over the place on that particular score. But give me your background in Buddhism and we'll just start there, okay?
Absolutely. I came into Buddhism about 10 years ago. I was making my way out of Christianity, and one of the things that I loved the most about Buddhism was it was my introduction into a life without an all-seeing God above us. It was kind of my first dipping my toe into the pool of no God, if you will. And I became fascinated with it. The whole concept of being able to do self-work, you know, to be able to work on yourself without the help of a God. And the more I studied it, the more that I fell in love with it and got to the point to where I loved it so much that I wanted to take Buddhist vows to actually become a Buddhist. It's one thing to study Buddhism. It's another thing to actually take vows to be a Buddhist.
And what's a vow entail? What's that include?
Well,
what are you vowing to do, I think, is my question.
Right. Well, we went to the Lobsang Monastery in Atlanta. Got together with a guy named Geshe Dadu Namgyel. He was our vow master. He is the auxiliary English translator for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And we took vows saying that we would, the whole vow process, there's three aspects to the Buddhist vow. That's the Buddha, the Dhamma, which is the teaching, and then you have the Sangha. So it's the Buddha, the Dhamma, which is the teaching, and then the Sangha, which is the people. And you take vows that you are going to follow the teachings of the Buddha, that you're going to respect any images or any written teachings. You're not to place them on the ground. You're not to step over them, and you're to actually respect them. And then the Sangha is you are respecting the Sangha, the community of monks and all the Buddhists around the world. You are becoming a part of them. So you take these vows to become a Buddhist, and they actually give you a Buddhist name. So you actually have a new identity. I got the name Tenzin Chodrak, which meant Dharma teacher. And then Ashley was given Tenzin Chokyi, which meant sunshine. So we both.
Well, let me get Ashley to weigh in here real fast. What's your take on all of this? Were you just sort of following this train in, or were you all in?
Well, I came from an abusive background, and when I had met Bobby, I was like, how in the world are you just letting things just roll off the back of, you know, just roll off the shoulder and not have any issues with it? And so he introduced me to Buddhism, and I really got more into the meditation part of it, and I started working on myself, and I really liked it because I started finding peace, for lack of better words, in it. And, you know, I found myself liking me a lot better than not. So just the more I dove into it with Bobby, the more I started really, really liking it, because I always had questions in regards to Christianity. And, you know, one of my biggest questions is, for 11 years of me getting abused by my ex, where was God when all that? You know, I'd sit there and pray and sit in a closet crying my eyes out, you know, wanting to know, God, what have I done so wrong to you have allowed me to go through this? And so when Bobby introduced me to Buddhism, I realized that, you know, I'm sitting there praying to somebody who really isn't there. And with Buddhism, it started to allow me to realize that it wasn't me that was causing this harm to myself, or, you know, that I hadn't done anything wrong. So of course, when you find out that, you know, it's not you that's done anything wrong, I almost created an Ashley as a magnetate.
Well, let me make sure I'm understanding you. For you, then, Buddhism helped to frame your own taking control.
Yes.
Realizing that, you know, my life is what I make it. My attitudes are what I make it. Buddhism for you was not an allegiance to a spiritual authority, or was it?
No, it was not.
It was more like, this is how I'm going to frame the taking control of my own mind and actions.
Yes, exactly.
Which is what Buddhism essentially teaches. It teaches you center-pointed mindfulness. It teaches you to sit in meditation and to work on aspects of your life that you want to work on through quiet contemplation. And Ashley and I would sit in our meditation room. We had our shrine and everything set up. And we would sit for 30 to 45 minutes a night on our meditation cushions, working and doing that inner work. So that aspect of Buddhism, even now, I can tell you I enjoy it.
Well, you understand how religious this all sounds.
Yes.
In some cases is. You mean you've got the Vow Master, which, by the way, sounds like an awesome sci-fi film, you know, Vow Master. You've got your shrine. I mean, You've got new identities handed to you by this organization. It sounds very religious.
Yes. Which is, it's funny you bring that up, because the more actually that I dove into it, the more I started looking at Bobby and going, you know, this sounds a lot like church.
Are you practicing Buddhist today?
No.
And the reasons for not being a practicing Buddhist today are?
The reason that we're not practicing Buddhist today, it's funny you ask that, because if you were to ask the Buddhist community, we are still Buddhist. Because in order for us to renounce our Buddhism, we have to renounce our vows to our vow master. So they would still see us as Buddhist. But the reason that I can't speak for you, Ashley, but I'll speak for me. The reason that I don't is because Ashley pointed out some things within Buddhism that I had my eyes closed to. She started pointing out loopholes. And when I sit back and I looked at the prostrations that we were doing, you know, the whole physical aspect of having to bow and everything else, it just, I don't know. It just didn't feel good to me, Seth. You know,
many of the people, though, who would defend it say that it's a practice. It's a way of, I come back to the word framing, because it's the only word for me that really I can place. It's like we are putting a structure around a philosophy. And if that structure includes some theatrics, if that works for you, then fine. I think that would be one of the defenses.
Yes.
Right. That is one of the defenses, because they are putting that structure around that philosophy. I like that you called it a philosophy, because we never saw it as a religion. I'm sure there are some people that were born and raised into Buddhism that may see it as a religion, but we were taught that it's not a religion, it's a philosophy, that it can be attached to any religion. You can practice Buddhism as a Christian. You can practice it as a Jew. You know, all these things that you can attach the Buddhist philosophy to that may improve it. But I just got tired of the theatrics. I got tired of bowing down, because I would ask myself, why am I bowing down to a guy that's dead?
Now, there's a question many of us who came from religion would like to know. Why did I spend so often bowing down to a dead person?
Exactly.
And obviously not living in any sense, and perhaps never living in any sense person, that kind of thing.
So. Exactly. And I'm sorry, but my days of bowing are over.
At the risk of being a little bit redundant, I'm interested in perspective. I've got several sets of guests on the show, and I'm asking them to teach us Buddhism from their perspective. I realize this is a huge, broad question, but give me the Cliff's Notes in your mind. If you're sitting over coffee with any member of the audience and you were to synopsize what Buddhism is and what it does, what would you say, either or both of you?
For me, Buddhism is a philosophy that helps you make yourself better and stop pointing blame to, you know, other sources outside of your well-being.
And how does it do that, Ashley, specifically?
It helps you to find your own faults within yourself so that you don't put the blame. Say, for example, I might find, and I'm not going to dare say I find Seth irritating, because that's not true.
Just stop.
But I might, for example, that you deal with the person inside you. I might find Bobby a very irritating person, but Seth might not find Bobby an irritating person. Therefore, the problem lies with me, not with Bobby.
Bobby, does she find you an irritating person? No, it's a whole other show. I'm sorry. It's a whole other conversation. I'm not going to open that Pandora's box right there. So.
More times than you would believe.
These are tools then, or framed as tools for dissecting the shit in your life that makes it worse and embracing the things that make it better. Bobby, you want to add anything to that?
Sure. Buddhism taught me that life itself is suffering. I mean, everything, sickness, death, all these things, it's called the Four Noble Truths. And it teaches you that life is suffering. And then when you look at it and going, okay, so life is suffering. This is why I'm going through this. But it's kind of like religion too, because then it gives you an answer. Life is suffering, but it can be stopped, and here's how you stop it. And it takes you through the Eightfold Path, and that's a whole nother topic there.
Yeah, we've gotten into the Eightfold Path already on the show.
It's
interesting stuff. I don't know that I agree that a solution has to be religious in nature. I mean, we can find solutions to the intellectual, to the psychological, to the physical problems we face, and we can say that they are just solutions, cause and effect solutions in this world. They don't have to be religious, do they?
No, not at all. And that's the aspect of being able to do that inner work, to sit there on the meditation cushion and do that inner work. There's no religion attached to that. There's no deity.
Why do I need Buddhism then? I mean, why can't I do this stuff on my own in another context?
That's just a thing, Seth. You don't need it.
You don't need it. The thing that Buddhism tries to teach you is that, A, you don't kill anything. Okay. You know, of course, the Bible says, you know, thou shalt not kill. But Buddhism is thou shalt not kill anything, and that we should treat every person as if they were our mother, because in some other life they might have been our mother, because they believe in the whole rebirth.
Well, okay. Wait. Hang, now we're cooking. No. Now we're getting into an area that we have sort of grazed over and glazed over, but we can actually talk about reincarnation.
I was kind of hoping to talk about
that. It's one of those things where I'm like, well, if it ain't a religion, we sure have some woo going on here, or a spiritual plane or past life or what have you. Talk to me about reincarnation.
Okay. Well, it's my understanding that in Buddhism, they call it rebirth, because you can come back as a human being again, but you come back with more riches, or depending on what you did in your lifetime or your current lifetime, like if you go out and murder somebody, then when you die, you might come back as a cockroach.
Karma.
Right.
Sounds extremely Hindu to me.
That's where it originated from.
I was going to say Buddhism is the stepchild of Hinduism.
Yeah, McAfee was talking about that earlier in the broadcast. It's interesting, being Hinduism is very much a religion with thousands of deities, to see Buddhism being an echo of it or a splinter of it. That's interesting stuff.
Yes, yeah. Very.
And then when you're thinking about rebirth and you're looking at your karma, right? Karma, essentially the law of cause and effect. What goes around comes around is basically karma. And when you're looking at karma and you're looking at something, I don't know if your other guests have talked about merit or not.
No, not yet. No, okay. Merit.
Merit. Merit is what you accrue through good deeds. And it is according to your merit and according to your karma that determines what you are, for lack of better words, reincarnated into, whether it's the human realm, the animal realm, or whatever realm you are to come back into. Now, this is where the woo bullshit really comes into play.
Yeah, because I always had a hard time believing that I could live this wonderful life and then maybe come back as a cockroach because of something that I did in a previous life. Because the rebirth doesn't just center around your current life that you're living right now. Awesome. It centers around your previous lives also.
So I'm building up equity the entire time. Yes. I'm living this life. And if I don't build enough up, or I have negative equity, then instead of coming back as emperor of a rich nation or, right, or something, I come back as a duck-billed platypus. And I'm like, well, how the hell did this happen? That's good to know.
Yeah. Which is why they lead up to the fact that, you know what, Seth, you could have been my mother in a different life. So that's why they teach you to treat everybody as your mother.
I'm going to have issues with it. I'm having a hard time processing how I'm going to have to talk to the vow master and sit before the shrine to figure this one out.
It's very complicated. I hear you. But the journey itself, Seth, I'll be completely honest with you, brother. The journey itself has helped me through so many difficult times in my life.
Well, I was going to tell you that I hear some real affection in your voice about much of these philosophies, and I understand why.
Yeah, because they really, really helped me. I mean, I can't tell you how many hours upon hours I've sat in meditation and was able to help myself. That's the thing I love about this, is I helped myself get over these things. It was all me. I did it.
It was through the teachings that we were able to help ourselves.
And you got people in the audience right now going, all right, they left, but they're admitting outright that it helped them and in many ways was amazing. They're a contradiction.
Well, if they want to see it that way, they can. Because trust me, there are many people that are still in this community that'll probably tell you that they still meditate today. Just sitting on a couch with the TV off, closing your eyes, that's meditation. It's not something that you have to sit in full lotus on a meditation cushion in a darkened room somewhere.
With a picture of the Dalai Lama in front of you.
There are people who still meditate today that are within the secular community.
A clearing of the mind, a centering, a relaxation exercise.
Exactly.
Yes.
By the way, full lotus is an animal I would like to be reincarnated as, I've decided. Full lotus just sounds amazing. I don't know. I'm sorry, guys. I'm a host with ADD. I'm just all over the place.
I don't feel bad because I do the same thing on our show.
I hear these terms and I just go off on a bunny trail and I have to be reeled back in. It's my fault.
The funny thing is, if you see somebody sitting like me in full lotus, try getting my behind out of full lotus. No, that's the funny thing.
You're going to have to call an ambulance.
Thanks there, dear.
I must say, though, you know, it's when I think of Buddhism and then I think of Georgia, I don't often put those two things together. And yet when I hear your wonderfully rich Southern accents, I can't help but smile. It just adds a warmth to the entire conversation about it. It's fantastic. So where are you both born and raised? Where are you based?
Savannah, Georgia.
Both of us.
One of these days when I'm down there, we get together. Do you do the crawfish, all that stuff?
We can.
I mean, do you, or do you just wait for the idiot tourist to come in so you can sucker us in with
you? No.
Because, you know, I'm driving by all these fried food places in Georgia and Mississippi and whatnot. And they're like, oh, get the crawfish. You know, you suck the heads out. And then you eat. I'm like, whoa, you do what?
Yes.
You
take the head off and then you peel the tail like it's a shrimp. Yeah. But then you take the head and you suck that goodness juices out of the head.
Hey, Seth, you have to suck the head, though, man.
I am full lotus. I'm going full lotus over this one, people. Any final thoughts on Buddhism before I move to the next chapter of this show? Anything that we missed or anything you'd like to, maybe a resource that you're aware of that might help educate those who want to go deeper?
There is BuddhaNet.net.
BuddhaNet.net?
Yeah, BuddhaNet.net is a great resource online for those people who are interested in just the intro of Buddhism that don't want to get deep into the Lam Rim and all these deep, deep concepts of Buddhism. If you're interested just in the intro part of it, go to BuddhaNet.net and it explains the Four Noble Truth. It explains the Eightfold Path. It explains the Ten Precepts. All these things that a beginner Buddhist would have to learn. That's a great resource.
Another resource too is somebody that we learned a lot from was Lama Marut.
Lama Samadhi Marut.
Maru.
Oh, God, I got to spell that? Is it a website? Is it a book? I find it at Barnes & Noble? What are you talking about?
He has a lot of downloads. So if you're a, you know, earbud in your ear type person, which I think a lot of us are because we listen to podcasts, but he is somebody who does teachings from start to finish I mean, and he's still going. You know, he teaches you how to meditate. He does teach you the Eightfold Path. He teaches you the Four Noble Truths. And it's somebody that we listen to.
He was my lama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On a regular basis. You know, that's
give me the name one more time just to make sure I have it here.
Well, his website is Lama, L-A-M-A, Marut, M-A-R-U-T. .org, lamamarut.org. He is, his name's Brian, but he was like us, a Christian who became a Buddhist, right? And now he's a lama, and he travels all over the world doing teachings. He's written two books. He's a regular guy, and that's what I like about him. You know, he's not sitting high on his pedestal. He's just sitting down on the couch talking with you.
He's got a PhD in comparative religions. That's interesting.
From Columbia, I believe.
He's written on his I'm looking at his website now. It says, a manifesto. Are you desperate enough to really want to incite happiness in your life? A true spiritual practice is for desperados. It's for rebels, an insurrectionist willing to pit themselves against a life defined by perpetual dissatisfaction, egoism, and greed. And the paragraph goes on and on. Interesting stuff.
And we just did an intro to Buddhism on our show. We did a 3-part series on intro to Buddhism. Just
all right. I'm definitely going to include links to those in the description box. Tell me real fast. I'll let you slug no religion required for me. You know, give me the website. Give me where people can find you, because I think a lot of people would like to pursue this conversation and listen to the both of you and sort of your own habitat as you do what you do. So slug it real fast.
And thank you for that. We are no religion required. We are live every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Spreaker. You can come in to chat room, chat with us. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spreaker, of course. And our website is nrrpodcast.com.
Fantastic. Bobby C. and Miss Ashley, you two can be my vow master any day. Thanks for your perspective and for being a great part of today's broadcast. And we'll see you over there at No Religion Required, okay?
Yes, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our brief foray into Buddhism, just kind of a Buddhism 101 once again. I want to say a huge thank you out to Rhonda Doral. She's joined the Thinking Atheist team. She's been helping me prepare these shows. She's also working, doing a ton of behind-the-scenes work on our 300th radio show, the live show, which is happening at the DoubleTree by Hilton in Dallas, Texas. And she's just been hugely instrumental in making that happen. So thank you to Rhonda. By the way, if you want to attend our 300th show live, be in the audience, be a part of the day. It's being sponsored by the Fellowship of Freethought Dallas. $15 tickets. You can go to fofdallas.org/300live. Next week, we're talking about health, nutrition, and the food, babe. That's going to be an entertaining and compelling show. I will see you back here for that. And have a wonderful week. Take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.